sometimes I get ideas. I want to hold you so much closer than I dare to. I want to scold you cause I care more than I care to. And when you touch me and there's fire in every finger, I get ideas, I get ideas. And after we have said goodnight and still you linger, I kinda think you get ideas too. Your eyes are always saying the things you're never saying. I only hope they're saying.
We'll fade down the Piatora Tango Ensemble from Canada, including dearly departed Robert Horvath, the piano player who just died, and let you know that you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison. A public BBC News coming up next, followed by A Public Affair.
This is Julie Candler with the BBC News. O.J. Simpson, the American football star who was cleared of murdering his wife in a trial that caused a global sensation, has died. He was 76 and had cancer. Will Vernon reports from Washington.
O.J. Simpson first found fame on the American football field, but he is better known for his landmark murder trial 30 years ago, which gripped the nation and the world. Simpson was accused of killing his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend Ron Goldman in Los Angeles. O.J. Simpson was controversially acquitted for the murders, but was found liable for the deaths 2 years later in a civil suit brought by the victims' families. In a statement announcing his death, the Simpson family said he passed away surrounded by his children and grandchildren.
The Israeli military says it's constructing a new land crossing into northern Gaza. The IDF spokesman said lessons were being implemented on how to better protect humanitarian agencies following what he called the tragic killing of 7 aid workers in a misjudged Israeli strike. James Landale reports from Jerusalem.
Israel has promised the United States it will do more to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. One of President Biden's specific requests was to reopen an existing crossing at Erez in the north. But the Israeli military says it is instead constructing a new land crossing in the vicinity. An IDF spokesman, Daniel Hagari, said the aim was for the new crossing to handle more than 50 trucks a day, both from the port of Ashdod and from Jordan. He said Israel's aim was for 500 aid trucks to pass into Gaza every day. Meanwhile, the United Nations aid agency, UNICEF, said one of its trucks entering northern Gaza from the south was strafed by Israeli gunfire without injury.
The widow of Alexei Navalny says he wrote an autobiography before his death 2 months ago in a penal colony in the Russian Arctic. It'll be published simultaneously in several languages in October. Danny Eberhard has this report.
Alexei Navalny's family and supporters believe he was killed on the orders of President Putin. The Kremlin denies this. Now, Mr. Putin's most outspoken critic is to speak from beyond the grave. Mr. Navalny composed his autobiography, titled Patriot, largely in Germany when he was recovering from what's widely believed to be a state-sponsored attempt to kill him in Siberia with a nerve agent in 2020. His widow, Yulia Navalnaya, said sharing his story would honour his memory, but also, as she put it, inspire others to stand up for what is right. The publisher called it his final letter to the world. It said it'll include previously unreleased correspondence from prison and expresses Mr. Navalny's total conviction that change will come in Russia.
World News from the BBC. President Macron has stressed his commitment to the rapid development of France's defence industry as a consequence of what he called lasting geopolitical change since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
At Bergerac in the Dordogne department of southwest France, President Macron was laying the first symbolic stone for a new factory for the French explosives company Urenco. He said France and other European countries needed to reinvest for the long term in their defence industries because the continent had entered a new era in which the post-Cold War peace dividend had disappeared. Even if the war in Ukraine ended tomorrow, he said, this new world would still be with us, with massive rearmament in Russia requiring more sustained military spending across Europe. The Urenco plant will produce explosive charges for artillery shells, which Ukraine says it needs more of urgently.
The Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has urged the US to continue to play its leading role in international affairs. Speaking in the Congress, Mr. Kishida called on America to overcome what he called its self-doubt and warned that without American leadership, Ukraine could collapse under the Russian invasion. Mr. Kishida was speaking while Republicans continue to block additional military aid to Ukraine. The US Justice Department has announced a new rule requiring all vendors who predominantly earn their profit from selling guns to obtain licenses and conduct background checks. Until now, only gun stores were subject to such measures. This allowed for loopholes where firearms sold on the internet or at gun shows were exempt. Portuguese bishops have set up a fund for financial compensation for the victims of historic sex abuse within the Roman Catholic Church. The church said the payments, yet to be determined, would be an apology and help victims recover their dignity. An independent commission estimates that about 5,000 children were abused for 70 years. BBC News.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
Six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Before we turn to our guest today, I want to caution you, our listeners, that some of you might find some of today's content disturbing. But some of it is essential to the story. In the days following the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, numerous reports of horrifying atrocities perpetrated on civilians of all ages in the area close to Gaza rapidly spread across the media sphere. And while some of the key accounts eventually came to be refuted by respected Israeli sources, the initial stories rapidly acquired a life of their own within Israel and internationally. By playing an important role in shaping opinion in Israel and especially in the U.S., those stories helped to legitimize the all-out war on Palestinian people, now increasingly considered an atrocity of genocidal proportions. Joining us today is investigative journalist Arun Gupta. His work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian, Jacobin, and so on, many others. Most recently, he has written several articles for The Intercept and Yes magazine that have probed the complex ways in which several of the most repeated and now debunked October 7th atrocity stories came about and what their impact has been. Arun Gupta, it's been quite some time, but welcome back to WORT.
Thanks for having me on, Alan.
In a March 24th piece for Yes, you noted how two influential reports, a New York Times investigation entitled Screams Without Words and a paper from the Physicians for Human Rights Israel, widely cited as fact the allegations that Hamas members systematically committed mass rape along with other atrocities on October 7th. Both reports primarily relied on what you referred to as known fabulists who concocted stories that they lacked any forensic evidence, photo evidence, or survivor testimony. Let's talk about the main source of atrocity allegations, especially of sexual violence and murder of children. That is Zaka. What is Zaka?
So Zaka is this Haredi organization, which means ultra-Orthodox. It was officially established in 1995. There was a precursor established about 1989, and it's an organization of ultra-Orthodox Jewish men in Israel who basically, they call themselves search and rescue, but the main thing they do is recovering human remains after mass casualty incidents. And so their whole story, excuse me, is rather, it is just utterly bizarre and pretty vile, actually, which we'll talk about a bit. But essentially, on October 7th, they were bankrupt because of all sorts of improprieties having to do with their finances. And also the founder of Zaka, Yehuda Meshi Zahav, had basically raped scores, if not hundreds, of Israeli boys and girls and young women over a 40-year period before he attempted to take his life in 2021. And what happened was he was slated to be awarded the Israel Prize, the highest prize, civilian prize, like the in Israel, like the Presidential Medal of Freedom here. And that was too much for his victims. And they started to come out of the woodwork and talk to the media about what he had done going back nearly 40 years. He tried to take his life by hanging himself. He slipped into a coma and died in 2022. So a year before the October 7th attack. So by the time we get to October 7th, Zaka is basically bankrupt. And what happens after October 7th, Israel is the second most sophisticated military in the world. They have an entire military unit that was mobilized, who is trained to go into mass casualty attacks, recover human remains, to preserve forensic evidence, and to do it under fire. They were told to stand down. Zaka was set in. And what I look at in both the Yes Magazine and the Intercept investigation, there is like strong evidence to believe that there was this deal struck with the Israeli government that in return for fake atrocity stories, Zaka was allowed to turn the October 7th post-massacre cleanup into basically a giant fundraising operation. And Haaretz had this incredible report where they actually have a photo of Zaka volunteers making fundraising videos using a corpse in a body bag as a prop. And Zaka, and the last thing I'll say, Zaka volunteers officials have openly stated they fabricate stories, right? None of this is conjecture. The most notorious one, Yossi Landau, who's been all over U.S. media, in the New York Times and other publications. We found on four occasions him saying, making statements such as, we use our imagination. The bodies are telling us stories. So they outright admit they fabricate atrocity stories. And those atrocity stories, the Israeli government said, enabled them to use greater force, right? So atrocity propaganda is used as a cover for the genocide. In return, Zaka gets his fundraising opportunity. That's part of the real story of October 7th.
You mentioned Yossi Landau, the role that he played in the counts that he gave. Go into that a little bit. Landau spread his tales far and wide with little pushback. Talk about what he alleged.
So what I uncover is basically there's a dozen sources, what I call the dubious dozen. They account for the vast majority of claims in the media, thousands of stories, right? There's literally been thousands of stories in the Western media alleging that mass rape occurred on October 7th. Five of them are Zaka volunteers, one being Yossi Landau. One of the fake stories he spread was of a pregnant mother being killed, the fetus being carved, you know, it's going to get graphic a little, fetus being carved out of her stomach and then stabbed. Completely false. numerous publications looked into it. The place that he said this happened, Kibbutz Be'eri, denied that it happened. The list of the dead, there is no was no pregnant woman there. But he told this again and again and again. And the New York Times platformed him in two different stories and never said once that he made up this atrocity. Then he made up a second atrocity of this family of four being killed and tortured, including two young children. And he goes into great detail about the torture. And, you know, again, I won't mention it. And again, completely fabricated. And Anthony Blinken actually used this story before the U.S. Senate in testimony. The key is the Israeli government, there are a number of officials, one in particular, Eitan Schwartz, a volunteer consultant in the National Information Directorate, which is Israel's Hasbara outfit, and Hasbara basically means propaganda. He said outright that after October 7th, the entire state of Israel was focused on fixing the narrative that Hamas equals ISIS, that the men of Zaka were crucial in convincing Western reporters what type of evil and human monsters we're dealing with. And again, and this deepened the legitimacy of the Israeli state to act with great force. And so we see this pipeline, right? These fake atrocity stories, they get amplified in this completely credulous Western media, and then they are picked up by Biden administration officials and it's treated as fact. Biden himself three times said that babies were like beheaded, completely false. He said he saw pictures of beheaded babies, a complete lie. His staff told him not to say this because they felt when it first came out, it wasn't true. He did it anyway. So you have the president of the United States on top of Netanyahu and other Israeli officials and all these senior White House officials basically spreading atrocity propaganda to justify the genocide. And a big part of that are these fake rape allegations.
You're listening to investigative journalist Arun Gupta. We're talking about drawing from stories, articles he did in Yes Magazine and The Intercept. We'll be opening up the phone lines at 608-256-2001. If you have a comment, a question, an observation for Arun Gupta, again, 608-256-2001. In your piece, you state that instead of offering verifiable evidence of war crimes, Zaka volunteers served another purpose, various purposes. That because of what you describe, they became as what you describe as an invaluable part of Israel's propaganda machine, which we've talked on. Take it further. That is, excuse me. You mentioned Eitan Schwartz, the head of the National Information Directorate, the office in charge of coordinating propaganda. Explain how Zaka volunteers influenced that news coverage.
Well, simply that they were the ones who were allowed to in all these massacre sites. The head of the, I forget his name, but it's in my article, the head of the Israeli press office, right? So the senior most spokesperson for the Israeli government talked about how they would bus in reporters to meet with the Zaka volunteers and officials who would tell them just the most ridiculous stories. There's another one, fabulous, named Simcha Greineman, who Israel put him before at this event they convened at the United Nations on December the 4th that just had wall-to-wall media coverage about like how Hamas committed mass rape. Yet what no one says is Simcha Greineman, for one, he claimed that they found the corpses of naked women tied to trees at the Supernova Festival. And you know, we're on video and I could see Alan looking at me quizzically, right? Because that's so absurd. That would leave so much evidence. Oh, and somehow there's no photos of this. There's no videos of this. There is no bodies that you produce. Simcha Grineman also said there were foreign fighters who came in on October 7th. And how did he know this? Because they found their IDs in their pocket. I mean, can you make up something more ridiculous and ludicrous than this? Yeah, sure. You know, foreign fighters always bring their IDs when they invade another country. He also told stories about butchered babies, about butchered children. Again, all lies. And yet these guys are completely given these platforms in Western media. But this is just how American media in particular operate. They will basically, they are just megaphones for every Israeli lie. The thing about the rape stories, the reason we've heard so much about them is because they've been Israel's only effective propaganda, right? Israel lies about everything. They lied about UNRWA employees being involved in the October 7th attacks. They lied about hospitals being command and control centers. They lie about Hamas using human shields, right? Now we know for a fact that Israel had this AI program to bomb families of suspected militants in their homes, even when the militants were known not to be homes. They lied about the bombing of the Al-Shifa hospital. On and on and on. But those lies get exposed pretty quickly and then they get dropped. The media never like be like, oh, well, this turned out to be a lie. They just stop mentioning it. But in the case of this rape hoax, it has gone on for months and months because Israel has weaponized Me Too. It's weaponized feminism. It's weaponized rape denialism and anti-Semitism to browbeat the media and a lot of leftists included into believing these lies. And one very important point I want to make is this Israel, I keep calling it a rape hoax, right? Because it is an industrial scale version of Jim Crow rape hoaxes. During Jim Crow, just in incident after incident, there were false allegations of a black man sexually assaulting or raping a white woman that was then used as justification for killing an individual or carrying out a pogrom. The destruction of Black Wall Street in Tulsa in 1921, killing up to 300 African Americans, it was estimated. That began as a rape hoax. The destruction of Rosewood, Florida began as a rape hoax in 1923. Around the same time, there was a pogrom in Atlanta, Georgia that began as a rape hoax. The Scottsboro Boy, Emmett Till, these all began as rape hoaxes. And the really important thing to remember is this inverts the sexual violence. The real victims are Black women of sexual violence, obviously, during slavery and Jim Crow. And this is also what's going on in Israel and Gaza, that while Israeli rape hoaxes are treated as truth in the Western media, there's been virtually no reporting on Israel's systematic, gender-based, and sexual violence against over a million Palestinian women and girls in Gaza that is being documented by UN groups.
You tell us that Western media lapped up Zaka stories. Give our listeners some idea of the global media echo chamber, the number of respected or respectable or and not so respectable media outlets that covered these stories.
Well, you know, the media has been decimated over the last 20 years, but when we were doing our examination, the ones who were platforming these stories were basically every big media outfit you can think of. So we're talking the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, PBS, CNN, ABC, and NBC, BBC. The other Western media, like, you know, Agence France-Presse, you know, German, of course, Germany has been horrible on this because they it seems like they never met a genocide that they don't like. But basically every media, a major media outfit, Reuters is another, to one degree or another, has platformed these lies, and they are outright lies. Some have been more circumspect, like Washington Post and Reuters. Others, like the New York Times, has just really acted as an arm of the Israeli government in putting out this propaganda. And on top of that, as you know, we were really the first ones to debunk the story. That's another story that I'll maybe get into in the future. Yes Magazine. And the thing is, virtually the entire New York Times story, their infamous December 28 story called Screams Without Words, that claimed there was this evidence of a mass rape on October 7th, virtually all their sources and findings have been completely discredited now, that they have shown to be false, they've shown to be fabricators, like the paramedic from Unit 669, who claimed he found one or two girls who were sexually assaulted, a video surfaced showing them fully clothed, that was a lie, their bodies. But the New York Times has not retracted their reporting, even though it's completely fallen apart.
I think you make a point in several places. You make the point that while the international media was covering these stories, fabrications, if you will, that they were exposed as such within Israel. That tells me so much about, you know, that well, it's often said that the range of opinion in the dominant media in Israel is far greater than that in the United States. And Haaretz, I see that you drew from Haaretz quite a bit of information, and they're incredible pieces, exposés.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really mainly Haaretz, Times of Israel has, and it's also like, it's more, you know, it's like Haaretz has been more explicitly debunking some of the stuff, but even they have done some horrible reporting on this. Then there are a couple of other print media outfits, Times of Israel, which is pretty right-wing, they're Likudniks. And then Yehudot Arachnot, which has the Ynet website that folks may be familiar with. More what it is you have to do kind of the Chomsky-style reading that, you know, Chomsky's like, you know, it's all there in the historical record, where they produce such a volume of reporting that you'll find these statements admitting the truth, right? That, you know, people aren't qualified, that this did not really happen. The thing about Eitan Schwartz, you know, admitting that they were using atrocity propaganda as cover for genocide, that comes from a very long Ynet profile of Zaka. And it's in Hebrew, right? So, you know, I use Google Translate to be able to read it and then got some Hebrew speakers to confirm the translation was accurate. But if you search, yes, you can find it. And what's remarkable is there has not been one story debunking Zaka in the Western media, even though, you know, the story I did is absolutely bonkers, absolutely crazy in The Intercept. I call Zaka is the intersection of where Enron meets Epstein Island meets George Santos, because the founder and his brothers were basically set up this, all these shell organizations were going around the world raising millions of dollars, were then pilfering it all. They were living the high life, new cars, plane tickets, five-star hotels, a multi-million-dollar villa, their food paid for. And they were using these resources, Yehuda Meshi Zahav, the founder, and two of his brothers, to entice children to rape them, handing out money, cell phones, Zaka certificates, and the like, to ensnare these kids in their webs. They were using Zaka vehicles to rape children. And the thing is, the number of actual rapes committed by the Zaka founder and his brother, like I said, it certainly scores, and it really looks like it may be hundreds, is far more than all the fake Israeli rape claims about October 7th combined.
Again, 608-256-2001. If you have a question, a comment, an observation for our guest today, Arun Gupta. I want to come back to the where we started at the head of the program today, and that is the two influential reports mentioned at the top of the hour, the position paper by Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the New York Times investigation that appeared last December. The PHRI, the Physicians for Human Rights Israel paper, stated there was sufficient evidence to require an investigation of crimes against humanity in regard to Hamas and so on. The New York Times claimed attacks against women were not isolated events, but part of a broader pattern of gender-based violence on October 7th. Yet you've pointed out, as we've gone into somewhat, that those reports were based on this extraordinary few sources. The 12 individuals counted for the vast majority. In brief, let's go back. That is, who were these 12 individuals? There's five that were listed as being from Zaka, and 11 of the 12 were tied to military. Talk about these sources.
Right. So, you know, the Zaka volunteers were basically, and, you know, it's not clear if they're really volunteers. I think they're getting paid. Haaretz says that they've raised over 13 million since October 7th. And I think the number may be far higher based on all the millions of dollars we've been able to identify that they've hauled in. So they talk about how, oh, these Zaka volunteers need support, they need money. So it sounds like they're actually paid and they're operating under the state. So they are under the rabbinate, which is, they are the ones who deal with, obviously, burial and Jewish rites and all that. And so at one of the main morgues at the Shura military base in central Israel, there are three individuals there who are what I call part of the dubious dozen, Sherry Mendez, and then the former chief rabbi of the Israeli military, who's a brigadier general, and then the current chief rabbi of the Israeli military, who is a general. All three of them tell fake stories about the pregnant mother being butchered. And what's interesting is you can see, again, I won't get into the details, how the details keep changing, right? It keeps getting more graphic, more extreme, you know, and we also heard like just countless stories about dead babies, all of which turned out to be false. 40 dead babies, 8 beheaded babies, babies and kids strung up on a clothesline, babies burned in ovens, like, and we kept hearing burned baby stories. Why? Because it evokes the Holocaust, right? Where else were there burned babies? You know, and all of these were fabrications. There was one 10-month-old infant, Mila Cohen, who was killed in her mother's arms. A bullet came through a door in the safe room. Then there was a Bedouin woman who she was in labor going to the hospital right as the attacks broke out the morning of October 7th. She was shot in the stomach, the abdomen. At the hospital, the doctors tried to deliver her unborn baby by C-section, but it died. Those were the only infants that died on October 7th, one or two, however you want to count it. But we have these all these stories about dead babies. Another one is this paramedic from Unit 669 who's been completely discredited. He was in virtually every single investigation we looked at, but no one looked at the fact the very first interview he did for an Indian right-wing Indian news station called Republic TV, he claimed his unit found a dead baby in a trash can with multiple stab wounds over it. Again, total lie, never happened. And that they found Arabic sentences written in the blood of their victims on the houses. I mean, this is just so ridiculous, right? Oh, and you don't have any forensic evidence or photographic evidence of this whatsoever. They make these wild claims, and then no one like bothers to investigate them. It's so absurd. So these three members at the Shura military base fabricated all these atrocities, including each one telling a different version of the pregnant mother and fetus being killed story.
608-256-2001. If you have a question, a comment, an observation for our guest Arun Gupta, give us a call again. 608-256-2001. Jade, our producer, tells us that we do have a caller. Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Alan, atrocity reports at the onset of major wars are a historic pattern. Reports of German outrages against Belgian civilians in 1914 were later discredited. 25 years later, the memory of that false propaganda caused the West to downplay early accounts of the Holocaust in 43, causing the failure of the FDR administration to intervene and the subsequent enlargement of that mega Nakba. This history plays out in the 2020s with the phenomena Mr. Gupta describes and the IDF overkill. Thanks. The pregnant mother stories were prevalent in 1914. Thank you.
I just want to jump in here because I'm very familiar with what our caller Steve is recounting in terms of stories about the Huns, the Germans in Belgium, and the rape of nuns and the bayoneting of babies and so on. It became, well after the fact, it became clear that those stories were generated by British intelligence, in part directed at an audience in the U.S. At the time, they were very concerned that the U.S. would remain on the side of Britain and France. It's often forgotten that at the time, upwards of a third of people in the United States, of European immigrants anyway, in the United States, were of from the Habsburg and Hohenzollern, the German and Austrian lands. And of course, there was a huge number of Irish that weren't about to get. They certainly didn't want to be involved on Britain's side. So yeah, some of that historical parallel is very informative. So thank you, Steve. Arun.
And yeah, I would add the Persian Gulf War, right? If we remember, what was the PR outfit that put what turned out to be the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S. Before Congress, where she tells us these stories about Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of incubators and leaving them on the floor to die. And just total, I think, was it Hill and Knowlton, the PR group? Just complete lie that she told. And meanwhile, and I think this is this is maybe like the most important point to make, right? The whole thing about why I keep going back saying it's like an industrial scale version of Jim Crow rape hoaxes. And you can go further back. This is the history of colonialism, right? They're the captivity narratives from the 1700s. These are both fictional and memoirs of women. They were very popular in colonial America, about women who were taken captive by Native Americans and, you know, claims that they were raped or that, you know, they killed themselves before they could be raped. Then you have the slave rebellions, right? Slave uprisings and this just complete terrifying fear that there's these rapacious bands of slaves. Then Jim Crow, and then it continues on, right? As American Empire goes abroad, you know, just, you know, the kind of savage Koreans and Vietnamese. So the narrative is that basically white feminine purity is being under threat from these savage hordes of darkies. Therefore, we need to wipe out the savage hordes of darkies. But what it does is it completely inverts the sexual violence, because obviously during the conquest, the genocide of the Americas, of Native Americans, Native women, by law, the royal decrees by the church, were allowed to rape Native women. You know, Black women during slavery, by law and right, the slave masters could rape them for sadism, for pleasure, to produce more slaves. You know, and we see this again and again. And like I mentioned, as American empire goes abroad, it is accompanied by sexual slavery and sexual violence. During the Iraq War, at one point, 50,000, this is just at one point, 50,000 Iraqi women and girls were forced into being sexually trafficked in countries like Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. So what Israel is doing is they are continuing this gender-based violence and sexual violence in Gaza, and this is being completely covered up. If I could have a minute, could I talk about that?
We have a minute, just...
I'll talk about it real quickly. So gender-based violence is things like the fact that there are something like, and this is an old statistic, as a couple months ago, there are 3,000 new widows, there are over 10,000 orphans, there is destruction of, healthcare and sanitation. So that means that women have zero neonatal, prenatal or postnatal care. So there are hundreds of birth complications a week among the tens of thousands of pregnant women. There are 100,000 lactating women whose breast milk has dried up. And, today, Samantha Power finally said North Gaza is in famine, of course, completely caused by Israel. There's the destruction of menstrual health in Gaza. And then that's gender-based violence. Then there's sexual violence, such as the assault and kill extrajudicial assassination of Palestinian women and girls, forcibly stripping them, sexually assaulting them during searches. There's also UNRWA has a report that has not been made public yet, but Al Jazeera got a copy and reported on it. I'll just try to be as vague as possible, basically stating that they have interviewed all these detainees who Israel, Gazans who were captured and taken hostage in Israel and then released, who said that they were sexually violated with electric sticks in orifices, right? So this is real documented sexual violence that the media is saying nothing about. And instead we get fake rape allegations that dominate the media.
We have some time left in the hour. Again, if you want to get in with a question, a comment, an observation for our guest today, Arun Gupta, give us a call at 608-256-2001. I want to stay with this theme of the function of atrocity propaganda. Certainly there's this, what's going on, you touch upon it in the longer arc of history, but this dehumanization that carries from Hamas to all Palestinians, the description of by Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant of Palestinians as human animals, and of course that dehumanization as the first step to genocide.
Yeah, I mean, you have to ideologically construct a people as subhuman, right? This is why, long before the Holocaust, that, like in Mein Kampf, Hitler was railing and amplifying these already prevalent views about Jews being like vermin, about being subhuman, and it just increased more and more over time. And really, this has been going on for something like 40 years. I don't think a lot of people are aware that if you go back to the 1950s, it's not like there was a lot of reporting on Islam or Muslims in the American media at the time, But generally, they were treated as more favorably than Hindus in India were, right? Because India was seen as hostile to the U.S. and Hindus were seen as kind of like backward and dirty, you know, Orientalism. And Muslims were tended to be presented as more sophisticated and rational and scientific, because obviously Islam for centuries was the center of like science, arts, and literature, while Europe was mired around in the muck of the medieval ages. And so over the last 40 years, really, we've seen the rise of just that to be a Muslim equals a terrorist, to be a Palestinian equals a terrorist. Edward Said, you know, his most important work, or the work that made the most impact, Orientalism, really is the one who described in a profound way how the West ideologically constructs the East as backward and barbaric, as superstitious and irrational, right? And so this just, and the Western media have treated Orientalism not as an intellectual history, but as a how-to manual. Because immediately after October 7th, there are all these demands. I mean, just to see the vile viciousness in publications like the New York Times, and the Atlantic magazine, and all these other Western media, just using the most dehumanizing and racist terms of, like, you know, Arabs and Muslims as barbaric and savage. You know, there was that infamous Thomas Friedman column that was literally no different than Der Stürmer, you know, the Nazi rag that was inciting genocide during the 1930s and 40s, where Thomas Friedman is comparing Muslims to insects, right? He calls Iran a parasitoid wasp or parasitical wasp, and you know, and says that it's laying eggs, you know, like Hezbollah and the Houthis and Hamas that eat their host. I mean, it is the most vicious, dehumanizing language that is exactly the same, and Fair had a piece showing this, exactly the same as what the Nazis were doing during the 1930s, and this is coming from the New York Times. You know, I mean, and I've said it on, you know, to on other outlets, that I genuinely think that the editorial boards of these newspapers should be tried at a new Nuremberg trial for incitement to genocide, and have the same punishment as the Nazi newspaper editors.
Arun Gupta, you have in your piece, excuse me, in your Yes piece, you have a you talk about the, what is the real story of October 7th, the takeaway? And there's a litany that you lay out coming from your perspective, your perspective. Talk about that, the real story.
Well, so look, I mean, I have looked, and it gets nauseating after a while. I have looked at every single photo and video I can find that is publicly available. And make no mistake, you know, there were plenty of atrocities committed on October 7th. Hundreds of non-combatants were killed on October 7th. But when you look at all the photos and videos, when you read all the reports, all the investigations, it's very clear what happened was Hamas came to kill and to take hostages. And that's brutal enough on its own. But Israel has been, you know, and they're experts at this, right? Trying to play the victim. So they essentially fabricated these rape claims because it has had the most impact. And so and because they have been weaponizing, you know, feminism and Me Too. So Israel has presented their claims to various UN groups, right? And there's specific UN groups, sub-agencies and bodies that deal with sexual violence during war, that deal with women in conflict and these sort of things that are for protecting women and girls. So some of the leading jurists and experts on these subjects, and they said to Israel, well, where is the evidence? What evidence do you have? The response of Israeli officials, and again, this is in the forthcoming piece from Yes Magazine, is to call them rape denialists. And we've seen this again and again. And even on the left, Kathapollett in The Nation and Jill Filipovich, this like progressive feminist and lawyer in the New York Times, calls anyone who is skeptical of Israeli rape claims a rape denialist. And I'll also add, this was the hardest story I ever had trying to place it at a publication. I was turned down by all these left-wing publications because they were afraid of being called rape denialists. So, you know, I think Yes Magazine should get an incredible amount of credit for having the guts to publish these investigations. But that is actually a big part of the story, how even left publications have not tackled this story because they're being afraid of called rape denialists, when that is central to Israel's strategy, calling anyone who is skeptical and asking for actual evidence rape denialists.
In that closing of that piece that I was alluding to, you of course talk about the fact that Israel exploited rape claims and feminism to advance its goals, that it promoted a false narrative to provide cover for genocide, to demonize all Palestinians, to convince Israeli society its brutal war was justified, and to bash the United Nations. Talk about that attack on the United Nations. That's been in the news quite a bit the past couple of months.
Oh, it's extraordinarily cynical, right? Because there, you have to actually understand how the UN operates, right? So there's been this narrative about, just completely repeated by Western media, US Congress, Israeli officials, that UN has been silent and complicit, and because they're silent, they're complicit in Hamas attacks. And this is a total lie, because there is one specific body that the UN set up a couple of years ago, this independent commission of inquiry on Israel, occupied Palestinian territories, and East Jerusalem, that has, I forget her name, this jurist from South Africa. She is one of the most respected jurists in the world. But the thing is, she does not pull any punches. She says that Israel is, the occupation is illegal, which it is completely illegal, that there's evidence Israel has committed war crimes after October 7th, which is a total understatement. But her commission of inquiry very quickly denounced the attacks of October 7th, said that they were disturbed about allegations of sexual violence. And they are the ones who have the actual investigative authority and powers to go in. And like 10 days, a week after the attack, they're asking Israel to allow us to come in to conduct an investigation. Israel refuses. They call them anti-Semitic, saying they won't recognize it. They even tell healthcare workers in the national healthcare system to not cooperate with the commission of inquiry. And so Israeli operatives and officials start attacking all these other UN agencies, such as UN Women, UNESCO. They have no power. This has nothing to do with any of their work. They have no investigative power. And they just start piling on massively, saying that they've been silent, they've been complicit, where it's all a complete lie. It gets so absurd that there's this campaign started called Me Too, Unless You're a Jew, that whose only purpose is to discredit UN women. And, you know, and this is what we've seen, right? Israel has used its genocide to try to destroy even the little UN oversight and involvement in the conflict, such as trying to destroy UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Work Agency, because they recognize that the Palestinians have refugees have a right to return. And so they actually start to do their own fake atrocity propaganda. They do this, you know, if you read my forthcoming piece, I link to it, where they create all this grotesque rape theater, right? That, like, you know, where they'll actually have people go out and act like Hamas militants raping women with, like, bloodied pants on public streets. Right. It's incredibly grotesque, incredible. It makes a mockery out of actual sexual violence. But this was all part of this concerted campaign to completely hammer the United Nations into submission. And it's been pretty effective because we've seen like 200 UN workers who've been killed in Gaza, with hardly any protest from the United Nations. And the United Nations is still running after Israel. What can we do to, you know, assure you of our good intentions? And the response of governments like the United States is to cut off funding to UNRWA, thereby being even more complicit in the genocide.
You know, you've talked at length about in debunking so many of these stories that you following the lead of Haaretz on occasion and other periodicals have chronicled that. You've used the word a litany of lies. I'm sitting there, I'm thinking that there are probably listeners out there who think, well, how do you back that up? What do you mean they're lies? How do you document it? One of the facts, of course, is that the stories are out there, the propaganda stories, the Hasbara stories, the atrocity stories are out there, and the damage has been done. So I guess what I'm trying to get to is your recommendations. One, of course, the articles you've done, give us some sites maybe, and perhaps some of the Haaretz material.
So I would say some of the best work has actually come from Mondo Weiss and Electronic Intifada as well. And then folks can also look at my reporting in Yes Magazine and The Intercept, and there are a couple of other Intercept reports that also relied on my work. And then, you know, Haaretz, like, I, you know, we've said, has done good work, but I would really point people to, you know, those four publications. And then Al Jazeera did this very good documentary on October 7th, where the director cites The Intercept, Yes Magazine, Electronic Intifada, and Mondo Weiss. And he also says Haaretz has done, you know, some good work as well. And so, you know, very quickly, what I'll say is, like, look, the New York Times report screams without words. It focuses on this one woman, Gal Abdush, and it's basically saying outright that she was raped because there's a video of her corpse with her dress pulled up. Turns out that story is almost certainly a lie, because the Times had they interviewed her surviving family and in-laws, and they had but didn't explain their text messages and voicemails from Gal Abdush and her husband Nagi, who were both killed, that show it was virtually impossible for any sort of assault to happen. And it would have had to have happened in about like a 5 to 10 minute window, right? So that's one case. The paramedic from Unit 669, he has been exposed as fraudulent. The UN report that did came out said outright, claims that that bodies were violated with objects is false. Claims that sexual organs were targeted with gunfire is false, and on and on and on. All these other sources have fabricated other atrocities, and they're also connected to these 11 of the 12 sources are Israeli military or come from the police, right? and no evidence, no photo evidence, no forensic evidence, no survivor testimony, except the one woman who is held captive in Gaza and who is entirely credible.
Well, Arun Gupta, it's been a fast, quick-paced hour. There's so much we could continue this discussion in regard to. I want to thank you for being with us this hour. You've been listening to Arun Gupta, investigative journalist with a very long track record in publications, mainstream and of the left. And he's done this work on exposing the atrocity stories that have come out of Israel and set loose in the media scape globally. So, Arun, I want to thank you very much. Excuse me. I want to thank Emmett for engineering and Jade for producing. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. Thank you very much.
Yeah. WORT Madison.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show, we'll be joined by economist Richard Wolff to talk about the economy. The number of jobs created last month was higher than expected, but so was inflation. We'll also talk about the latest U.S. posture towards China as President Biden today meets with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. Then later we'll talk to Jake Johnstone of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He argues that international aid to Haiti has helped destabilize that country while making U.S. companies rich. That's next on Letters in Politics.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The American football star O.J. Simpson, who was cleared of murdering his ex-wife in a trial that caused a global sensation, has died. He was 76 and had cancer. Tom Bateman recalls the rise and fall of O.J. Simpson.
O.J. Simpson was an NFL star, a running back, an iconic footballer who was remembered so much for all of that, but it will be the trial of 1994, of course, his acquittal, after he was charged with the murders of his former wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend, Ron Goldman, in 1994. One of the most watched televised trials in the history of the United States that was seen to sort of divide the country along racial lines, crystallizing so many of those divisions in America.
O.J. Simpson was later found liable for the killings in a civil case.